Waiting for our dean to come because usually that's the opening remarks. Unfortunately, it must be somehow still up there. I decided just to go on because we can make longer. I don't have to do the opening, but that's what I'm exposed. That's I don't do much, but I just go through the agenda as you can see. And the way we do it is that, as I said, beginning with the opening remark, then I ask one of our colleagues to introduce our guest, and then the guest speak, and then we have the lecture. Public lecture is now, we are doing this for almost 12 years, and it's really popular. We are fortunate to have, an honor to have speakers like Professor Charles today, and every year we enjoy this type of lectures, and it's associated with my course in astrobiology. And I just need to thank one person key to establishing this astrobiology at the field. 1996, became chairman of the Department of Biology, and when I visited McGill from NASA at the time, he actually was the one who encouraged me to stay on and go return to NASA, and then he actually managed to convince his colleague at Anatomy Cell Biology to be a biology position in his department in my head of it, but that was. And then from that time, I mean, he was really a major supporter. I thank him because just that's one after 30 years being chairman, we started at the same time, and we have been very successful promoting this program here again. And now, without further delay, I would like to ask Dr. Brandenburg to introduce our guest, and then I will moderate the discussion after the end of the Dr. Krauss. Thank you, Dr. Krauss, and everybody for coming here, and I hope you will enjoy. David, come here.
Okay, it's a great honor for me to introduce tonight's speaker, Professor Lawrence Krauss. Professor Krauss is a distinguished scientist, a distinguished science writer, and a forceful public intellectual. Professor Krauss is Canadian. He grew up in Ontario. He was a math and physics major at Carleton in Ottawa. And then he went on to do his graduate studies at MIT, and this is actually where I met him, in Boston. From MIT, he went to Harvard as a junior fellow. It's quite a prestigious position. He was then junior faculty at Yale. After that, he moved on to Case Western University as distinguished professor and chair of the physics department, where he built one of the best, most vibrant cosmology research programs in the United States. Since 2008, he's been at Arizona State University as a foundation professor, and I don't really know what that means. And there are a lot of other titles associated with his position, which I'm not going to list. So I know Lawrence mainly through his scientific work. So there'll be some fancy terms, which not all of you might know of. He's worked on dark matter. He's worked on gravitational waves. He's worked on solar neutrinos. And he was one of the first cosmologists to realize that the universe is dominated by something mysterious, which is now called dark energy. He realized this many years before the supernova data. Again, a fancy word. Now, some of you may know Professor Krauss through his science writing. His first book was called Fifth Essence, and the second one was called Fear of Physics. And some other people here in the audience might sympathize with that title. Now, this book, since I'm a physicist, I did not read this book. This book was so well written that the editors asked him to write another book called The Physics of Star Trek. And many physicists got rather envious because they liked Star Trek and would have liked to be asked to write this book themselves. It goes on, I'm not going to mention titles of other books. Now, in recent years, Professor Krauss has been doing some very important work in a different domain. He's been doing work which some people call work as a public intellectual. So he lives and works in the United States, and he speaks out in his lectures very forcefully in support of science and against some other things, for example, intelligent design. And this can bring him quite a lot of enemies in certain areas. Most recently, he's also become very concerned with the threat of nuclear weapons, and he's in fact the chair or co-chair of the board of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. That's a magazine which, since the Second World War, has been calling the attention to the dangers of nuclear arms. He was on Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign science advisory team. Professor Krauss has received many prizes for his scientific research, for his science writing, and also for his outreach work. But you haven't come here to hear me speak, but you've come here to hear Lawrence. So let's welcome Lawrence to McGill.
Very well done. Very well done. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Thank you all for coming out. Thank you, Robert. You could have used fear of physics. But anyway, I'm sorry for the uncomfortable surroundings for some of you, but we'll try not to have a fire in here, so that will be good. We'll try and have some fun. So I had music playing earlier, but we had to turn it off so you could hear about me. But I want to begin with this quote, which is one of my favorite quotes. I mentioned it to the class I was speaking at today, and I paraphrased it. I think I got it right. The initial mystery that attends any journey is how did the traveler reach his starting point in the first place? And I want to present for you a mystery story today, and it's the best kind of mystery story because we don't know who did it, and maybe some of the young people here will be inspired to try and answer that question. I can't generalize. You know, I'm a scientist, but generalizing from my time today, and I looked up, I thought maybe you might need to know that these are stars. And we can see them now that I moved to Arizona. When I lived in Cleveland, I needed to explain that as well to people, that these are stars. They occur at night when the sky is clear. And they're beautiful when you get away from the city. And this is a globular cluster, in fact. But the thing that's most remarkable about the universe is that we realized, as beautiful as the stars are, they're just the tip of a cosmic iceberg. And the really important stuff in the universe is the stuff you can't see. And we'll talk about that. So let's begin the mystery story. I want to see how far I can go. I like to wander, but I'm tethered with this noose here. Okay, so it'll be interesting when I get pulled back. Okay. So let's begin. It was a dark and stormy night. And Albert Einstein had just developed his greatest theory, his greatest discovery, the theory of general relativity, which was a theory not just of the first theory in the universe, not just of how objects move through space, but a theory of space itself, space and time. A theory that told us that space is dynamical and can respond to the presence of matter. And it was a beautiful theory, and he knew it was the theory of the universe. The problem was that it didn't describe the universe in which we live. That does not bother physicists nowadays, but it used to. And Einstein was very concerned about that, and so he did something about it. The problem with the theory was really quite simple, and all of the students here know this. Gravity sucks, okay? And in 1915 and 16, when Einstein wrote down the theory, the universe was static and eternal. That was the conventional wisdom among the scientific community at the time, that the universe had been around forever in the same state and would more or less exist forever in that state. And that's impossible if you have a theory of gravity that's universally attractive, like Newtonian gravity, in fact, and also in general relativity, because you put stars and galaxies around and they'll eventually get pulled together. They'll collapse. And so you couldn't have a static universe. Now, Einstein was a very creative guy, so he figured a way around that. So I want to show you So I'm going to show you Einstein's equations. We're going to lock the doors now. So here they are. Okay, are we okay with this? There are lawyers in the audience. This will help. Okay. So it's not completely facetious to write Einstein's equations this way because the left-hand side and the right-hand side are quite different. The left-hand side represents generally the geometric objects associated with general relativity, the curvature of space. And the right-hand side is the source of that curvature, the energy and momentum of the universe. And this the fact that the energy and momentum of stuff in the universe produces curvature, which then affects the energy and momentum, that nonlinear relationship is what makes general relativity so interesting. And, of course, I'm a theoretical physicist, so I have to write this down this way. There, that's much more illuminating. And this theory, as I say, that was the theory of general relativity, but it's just like Newton's law of gravity. Gravity sucks. And so that was the problem. And what he realized is consistent with the mathematical symmetries that had led him to develop his equation. He could add a term to the left-hand side, which he called a cosmological term. And this term would produce a very small repulsive force throughout empty space. So small that you couldn't measure it here on Earth. It wouldn't affect the results of the planets around the sun or anything like that. But it could build up over the scale of the universe and hold apart distant stars and galaxies against the gravitational attraction, and he felt result in a static universe, which was the universe he thought we lived in. Now, no sooner did he write this down than problems began to arise. And in fact, the particular problem was that we began to realize that the universe is postcard from Einstein to Hermann Weyl, who's a very famous mathematical physicist. And some of your German Roberts is probably better than mine here, but it basically says from 1923, it says, if you get rid of a quasi-static universe, then out with the cosmological constant. Because he realized if the universe was expanding, you didn't need this damn cosmological constant anymore, because gravity could just be attractive. If the universe was expanding, then gravity could work to slow the expansion. And the big question would become, is there enough gravity to stop the expansion and reverse it in a big crunch, the reverse of the Big Bang? And so that became the central question, in fact, of 20th century cosmology. And he really said, I wish I'd never introduced that cosmological concept. We didn't need it. It was my biggest blunder. Now, before we go back to him a little bit, I want to talk about, you know, we began to realize the universe was expanding as early as 1923. But the person that convinced the world of this is this guy here. And I love to show his picture because he gives me great faith in humanity. This is Edwin Hubble, and he began life as a lawyer and became an astronomer. And so there's hope for absolutely everyone, I like to think. And he did many things that are important. In fact, actually what he did with this telescope here was something that's not quite relevant to the talk, but I'll mention it to you anyway, because I want to give you a sense of what exciting times we're living in. In 1925, before the Mount Wilson telescope was built, there was a big controversy. The controversy was, when we looked out with telescopes, we could look at our galaxy and we'd see these fuzzy things, which were called nebulae, which is Greek for fuzzy thing. And those nebulae, there was a big debate about what they were, and people didn't really know. In fact, in 1925, we knew of one galaxy in the universe, our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. That was the universe. And what Hubble did in 1925 is use that large telescope to realize and demonstrate that these nebulae, many of them, were in fact not in our galaxy, but were other island universes, other galaxies. And we now know that there are 400 billion galaxies in the observable universe. But in a single human lifetime ago, 85 years ago, we knew of one. So that's how much our picture of the universe has changed and why it's continuing to change and surprise us all. But the discovery that Einstein, Hubble really made that was the one that we want to celebrate now, was another equally remarkable discovery, and that was that the universe is expanding. And how did he know that? Well, he this is what he saw. These are not sperm, these are galaxies. And this is our galaxy here. And what he discovered was as we look out at other galaxies, they're on average all moving away from us. And moreover, those that are twice as far away from us are moving twice as fast. Those that are three times as far away from us are moving three times as fast, and so on. So what does this tell you? Well, obviously, it tells you we're the center of the universe. Right? I mean, it's obvious. But as my daughter used to remind me on a daily basis, that's not true. what it really tells us is that the universe is expanding. Now, it's hard to explain why this is the case, and I tried a lot of different ways. But the problem is that we live in our universe, or most of us do, anyway. And so we're stuck here, and we get this myopic picture of things. So if we want to really see that this implies the universe is expanding, we have to get outside of our universe. And it's a lot easier to get outside of a universe that I can write or draw on this screen. So here's a universe I've created, a two-dimensional universe, where galaxies are at regular intervals. And you can see that at time t1 it's this big, and at time t2 it's this big, it's expanded. So if you're standing outside the universe, it's obvious that this universe is expanding. But what happens if you're on one of these galaxies? Well, pick this one. Okay, what would you see? To see what you'd see, I just superimpose this image on top of itself, putting that on top of itself right there. And what would you see? Well, you'd see exactly what Hubble found. Every galaxy is moving away from you, and those that are twice as far away have moved twice the distance in the same time. Those that are three times as far away has moved three times the distance, etc. And it doesn't matter what galaxy you pick. Any galaxy, you'll see exactly the same. So this is what Hubble saw, and this tells us that, you know, depending upon whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, either every place is the center of the universe or no place, you choose. But it doesn't matter. What it really means is the universe is expanding. And that profoundly changed everything, by the way. It had profound philosophical implications because it meant the universe had a beginning. And in fact, at the time, shortly thereafter, the Pope, in fact, issued an encyclical pointing out that science had proved Genesis. An unfortunate statement, but we won't go into that. We can in the question period if you want. But it really did. It changed everything. It meant the universe had a beginning, and it meant the universe had a very different future, and we'll talk about both. Now, this is so important, I want to explain to you how Hubble knew this and how we now measure the expansion of the universe today. So I want to use this slide to help start. These are two cowboys on the plane, and they're talking to one another, looking at that train. And one cowboy says to the other, "I love hearing that lonesome wail of the train whistle as the magnitude of the frequency of the wave changes due to the Doppler effect." And what, of course, they're referring to is the fact that when a train comes towards you, the whistle sounds higher because the waves are scrunched up. And when the train is moving away from you, the waves get stretched out to lower frequency. And the same thing happens for very different reasons for light. So we can use this. We can use the fact that light gets stretched out, and we can look at the light from stars. And what Hubble discovered is that the light from more distant objects was stretched to longer wavelengths. The longer wavelengths of the visible spectrum are the red wavelengths, and therefore this is called a redshift. And stars that are further away, galaxies that are further away, have light that's more redshifted, and the redshift is proportional to their speed. So remember, Hubble measured that the velocity is proportional to distance. So if we want to measure that, we have to measure velocity and distance. And the redshift is the easy part. It's the velocity. We can measure immediately the velocity of distant objects by looking at redshift. But how do we measure distance? That is much harder. Because, you know, we don't have tape measures that are that long, and we need to find a way to measure distance. And how do we do it? Well, we use the laws of physics, of course. I could measure the distance to that room if I turned off all the lights but that spotlight back there, maybe 200 watts. And if I had an old-fashioned camera made before most of the students here were born that had a light meter on it. They used to have light meters in the old days. And so if I knew there was a 200-watt light bulb there and my camera said there was 1 watt of light coming into my camera, then I could work backwards knowing how the light spreads out and figure out how far away the back of the room is. Most of you could do that, perhaps. But the problem is the universe isn't populated with 200-watt light bulbs. If it was, life would be easy. So we have to find the equivalent, something whose intrinsic brightness we believe we understand, and then we look at it through a telescope, we see how bright it looks, and therefore we try and infer how far away it is. And those things we call standard candles. And that's been the search in much of the last century in astronomy to try and find standard candles which we could use for distances. And that's the hard part. And I think this is Hubble's original data. From 1929, this is velocity proportional to distance. And this is one of the reasons why he was such a great scientist. He knew to draw a straight line through that data set. It's not so obvious. But he also did us a huge favor. He got the answer wrong by a factor of 10. And astrophysicists have been trying to emulate that ever since. But it actually was, again, caused another controversy. because he discovered the universe was expanding a factor of 10 faster than it actually is. And if you work backwards, once you know how fast the universe is expanding, you can work back and figure out when it all began. And with this number, it turns out the age of the universe was less than about 1.5 billion years old. And that was a problem in 1929, because even in 1929, we knew that the Earth was much older than 1.5 billion years old. Well, except in Ohio and Alabama and a few places like that. And that caused a problem. It's always embarrassing if the Earth is older than the universe. But in this, it's happened several times, actually. But in this case, the problem was that, of course, he'd gotten the answer wrong by a factor of 10, not because he was a crummy astronomer, but because he didn't have good standard candles. And that's what we've been trying to prove upon. Nowadays, we have much better standard candles. This is a Hubble Space Telescope picture of a distant galaxy. And it's a beautiful picture, like many of them. But it's a remarkable picture. It's a galaxy far, far away, long, long ago. And you see that there's a star here that's as bright as the whole center of the galaxy. And in the center of the galaxy, there are about 10 billion stars. Galaxies have about 100 billion stars on average. And this star is as bright as 100 billion or 10 billion stars. Now, the first thing you'd assume is that the star is just in our galaxy, got in the way of the picture. That's a reasonable assumption. But it's not the case. It actually is a star on the edge of that galaxy, and it is shining with the brightness of 10 billion stars. How can that be? Well, it's a star that's just exploded, a supernova, the brightest cosmic fireworks. And when stars explode, they shine with the brightness of 10 billion stars for a brief time. And you can see them across the universe. Now, it turns out that these type of supernovae are great standard candles. Now, unfortunately, supernovae don't occur very frequently in galaxies, or perhaps fortunately. Stars don't explode too often. About once per 100 years per galaxy. Okay? But it's good that they do explode, because it's good for you that they explode, because you're all here because they exploded. Because in the beginning of time, in the early Big Bang, the only elements that were created, well, were hydrogen and helium and a little bit of lithium, which is unimportant cosmically. Maybe it's important to some people in this room, I'm not sure. All the stuff that's really important to you, the carbon, the nitrogen, the oxygen, the iron, all that stuff was not created in the Big Bang, but in the fiery nuclear furnaces at the cores of stars. And the only way it could get into your body, so you could be alive today, is if the stars were kind enough to explode and spew all that material out. So you are really stardust. It really is the most poetic thing I know about science. Every atom in your body was once inside a star that exploded. And the atoms in your left hand might be in a different hand, from a different star than the atoms in your right hand. And so think about that. It's really quite amazing. Now, the problem is, if we want to use these once per 100 years per galaxy, how could we use these to study the universe? I mean, that's a pretty long time. So, I mean, well, 100 years, that's, you know, we could assign a graduate student to each galaxy. That would work, right? Because, you know, 100 years is about the right time for a PhD, and graduate students are a dime a dozen, so they're dispensable. But we don't need to do that because of another remarkable fact about the universe. It is big and it is old. And rare things happen all the time. So in fact, if you went out in the night, on a clear night away from Montreal, and looked up at a dark spot in the sky, held your hand out with maybe a dime-sized hole in an empty dark spot in the sky, if you looked at that dark spot in the sky with one of the biggest telescopes we can look at on Earth nowadays, you'd see about 100,000 galaxies. Okay, because there are 400 billion of them out there. So now think about it. Once per 100 years per galaxy, 100,000 galaxies, if you work it out, on a given night, you'll expect to see 10 stars explode. And astronomers use that. They apply for telescope time, and they say, tonight we're going to try and see 10 stars explode. They might see 9, they might see 11, or it might be cloudy, they might not see any. But we can therefore look at these objects and actually use them. Here's a little movie. We can follow their evolution as they explode over the period of a month and get bright and dark, and this will repeat itself. Here's this star will explode, there's its brightness. That's its color, so we know it's a very particular type of supernovae called a type 1A supernovae. Doesn't really matter. But this type of supernovae is a standard candle. And it has allowed us, because they're so bright, we can use it to measure the distances not just to nearby objects, but to distant galaxies on the other side of the visible universe. And we've been able to measure distances and measure speeds, and now we can measure the Hubble law, the expansion of the universe, much better than Mr. Hubble could. Of course, this was made after the profound discovery that on a log-log plot, everything's a straight line. But nevertheless, even taking for that guide for the eye, we can now measure the Hubble constant, the expansion rate of the universe, not to a factor of 10 uncertainty, but to 10%, or even better, maybe 5. So we now know exactly how fast the universe is expanding. And in fact, as a result for that and other reasons, we know how old the universe is. We know it's 13.72 billion years old, which is amazing that we can say that with a straight face. It's a four significant, every digit there is significant. We know how old the universe is. Okay, now, let's get back to Einstein. The universe is expanding. He said, I wish I'd thrown this thing out. It was my biggest blunder. Get rid of it. The problem is, it's kind of like trying to get the toothpaste back in the tube after you got it out. If Einstein hadn't invented the cosmological term, someone else would have, because now we think of it in a very different way. And with the miracle of modern mathematics, we can rewrite this equation. Okay? And now that's a small step for a mathematician, but a giant leap for a physicist. Not because it's that hard to put that over there, but because now, remember, this is on the other side of the equation and has a very different significance. What was over here looked like it had something to do with the curvature. When it's here, it looks like it's a new contribution to the energy and momentum of the universe. Now, what could give such a contribution? The answer, nothing. And by nothing, I mean nothing. Namely, if you take nothing, if you take space, and you get rid of all the particles and all the radiation, so there's nothing there, if that space weighs something, then it will produce this term. Now, that sounds crazy. Empty space shouldn't weigh anything. But the universe is sometimes crazy. That's what physics has taught us. The universe is strange, stranger than we could have imagined, in fact. That's why we need to do experiment and not just pure thought. And so, empty space should have zero energy, except for the fact that empty space isn't so empty anymore. Due to two of the great pillars of 20th century physics, special relativity and quantum mechanics, when we put them together, we now realize that space is really a boiling, bubbling brew of virtual particles popping in and out of empty space at a time so short that we can't see them directly. Now, that sounds like philosophy. It sounds like counting angels on the head of a pin. If we can't see them directly, what's the point of talking about them? Well, these virtual particles, as they're called, can't be seen directly, but their effects can be measured indirectly. In fact, I want to show you a little movie of what empty space actually looks like. This is the empty space inside of a proton. And this is not just an animation. It's actually based on a calculation from quantum mechanics and special relativity. It's a space inside of a proton. And this was shown at the Nobel Prize ceremonies a few years ago by the people who won the Nobel Prize because their theory allowed us to, in fact, understand how space looks like inside of a proton. It's not empty at all. In fact, it's got these fields bubbling in and out of existence. And these fields are important. They're actually responsible for your existence. Because most of the mass of protons and neutrons is not made of the quarks that they're made of. The mass actually comes from these fields that are popping in and out of existence, these quantum fields, as they're called, due to the strong interaction. So you are here, and you weigh something because empty space inside of a proton is full of these virtual particles. Now, given that, we can then ask, okay, if the virtual particles give mass to protons, what about to really empty space where there are no protons? Do they give any energy to empty space? And we can do a calculation. And when we do it, we come up with the worst prediction in all of physics. We come up with, you can't see the one there, but we predict that the energy of empty space is roughly a gazillion times the energy of everything we see. And as I said, it's the worst prediction in all of physics because we know that the energy of empty space, even if it isn't zero, can't be much greater than everything we see because we wouldn't be here if the energy was this great. This is 120 orders of magnitude larger than this. But this problem's been around since I was a graduate student. It's called the cosmological constant problem. And we knew the solution. We didn't know how to get the solution, but we knew what it must be. The energy of empty space is zero. Somehow, this big number must be canceled. Why? Well, because, you know, if the energy of empty space was the same as the energy of everything we see, we'd cancel this big number, except in the 121st decimal place, we'd have a 1 there or something. Now, we don't know how to do that in physics, to cancel two big numbers, leaving something 121 orders of magnitude smaller. But zero, we know how to do in physics. Zero is easy. symmetries of nature can produce things that are equal and opposite and cancel exactly. So we theoretical physicists knew the answer. We knew there was some symmetry of nature that we didn't yet understand that would explain to us why the energy of empty space is zero so we could sleep at night. So we knew the answer, and we always know the answer, and sometimes we're right. But in this case, the point is that just knowing the answer in your head is not good enough. That's not science. Physics and even cosmology is an empirical science. And if that's the case, you want to know it by measuring the energy of empty space. So how can you measure the energy of empty space? Simple. You weigh the universe. And how do you weigh the universe? You stand on the shoulders of giants. This is a particular giant. I took this picture when I was off Sweden. This is an island off Sweden called the island of Ven. It used to be an island off Denmark. And this is a statue of a guy named Tycho Brahe. He doesn't have the tip of his nose if you look at it very carefully. He was actually given an island because he was one of the last people to actually see a supernova in our galaxy, and the Emperor of Denmark gave him the island. It was a nice thing back then to be a scientist if you saw something like that. And he got the island and all the serfs to... And he built an observatory before the invention of the telescope, in fact, and every night just measured the position of the planets on the sky. That's all he did for 20 years. And then he got kicked off the island for being a crummy feudal lord, and a new emperor came in. And he moved to Prague, where he found this hapless assistant named Johannes Kepler. And he did what we all do to our assistants. He gave him the data and said, figure it out. And Kepler spent the better part of his life trying to figure it out and discovered some laws of motion around the sun, how the planets moved, and Newton used those to develop his theory of gravity. And in fact, we can use gravity to weigh objects, and we've been using gravity to weigh objects ever since. That's how we use gravity to weigh the Earth and the sun and the galaxy, and eventually the universe. Now, we care about how much stuff there is, not just because we want to know the energy of empty space, but because we want to know the future. In fact, actually, the reason I, as an elementary particle physicist, got into cosmology about 30 years ago is because I wanted to be the first one to know how the universe would end. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And now, general relativity tells us that space is curved. Now, I can't draw three-dimensional curved universes. I can draw two-dimensional ones, so that's what these are. But it turns out space can exist in one of three geometries. It can be either open, closed, or flat. Now, what does that mean? Well, here are the two-dimensional versions. But a closed universe is easy to understand pictorially, even a three-dimensional closed universe. In a three-dimensional closed universe, if I look far enough in that direction, I will see the back of my head. Okay? Light will come around the universe and come back in. It's closed. An open universe is infinite, in this case, and a flat universe, which is the boundary between these two, is also infinite. And that sounds really nice in cocktail parties, but what's important is the operationally, in a universe full of matter, a closed universe will expand, stop, and collapse. Okay? An open universe will go on expanding forever at a finite rate, and a flat universe is the boundary between the two. It will just expand forever, slowing down, and ultimately stopping, but only after an infinite amount of time, never recollapsing. And this became the question of physics. Which universe do we live in so we can determine the future? To know which universe we live in, we have to know how much matter there is, because matter curves space. And that's why I wanted to know how much matter there was. And so we've tried to weigh the universe over the last 30 years, and we have done it. And here's a picture of how we now do it. I could give a whole lecture on all the efforts to do it over time, but this is the punchline. We're now actually up to only about 10 years ago. We've jumped to 10 years ago when we could finally weigh the universe. Now, how do you weigh the universe? You weigh the biggest objects in the universe. And the biggest objects in the universe are clusters of galaxies. Galaxies like to hang around. And here's another Hubble Space Telescope picture. Every dot in this picture is a galaxy, not a star. And in every galaxy, there may be 100 billion stars and civilizations that are long gone and audiences listening to lectures. And it's, every time I look at a picture like this, I find it inspiring, in fact. But clusters of galaxies are really big. The distance across this cluster is almost 10 million light years across. It takes light 10 million years to get from one side of that picture to the other. And since these are the biggest bound objects in the universe, if we can weigh them, we can weigh everything. Okay, because if we can weigh them, we know. Now, the first student is leaving, so I'm supposed to tell you that the students who are taking an exam, there are a few of you, can feel free to go and miss the punchline and the really inspiring stuff. those of you, you know, if you really want to think the exam is more important than this lecture, you can now leave. And the other rest of the audience who want to leave now, can you pretend they're students and go take the... So you have my permission to go now. We'll let them go for a second. I'm sorry to see you go. But the good news is there are seats for other people now. Okay. Now, getting back to this cluster of galaxies. We want to weigh this object because if we weigh this, anything that can fall into anything will fall into a cluster. And now when you look at this picture, there's something weird about it. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see there are these weird blue things. And what are they? Well, this is a phenomenon that Einstein first predicted in about 1937, I think, although he said it would never be observed because he underestimated observers, which is easy to do. It's a phenomenon called gravitational lensing. Einstein realized that if mass curves space, mass can act like a lens. Because you have an object back here, and a bright object, and light comes out from it. If you have a very massive object here, the light can bend around it and come back to an observer who will see an object magnified, just like my glasses magnify things. Or if you have like a cut glass goblet with lots of rough edges, you look through that, you'll see many images of this room. And he realized mass can do that if you have enough of it. And he said it would never be observed, but here it is being observed. This is a gravitational lens. All of these blue, this is a cluster that's almost maybe 3 billion light years away from us. And all of these blue things here are different images of the same galaxy, a single galaxy located several billion light years behind that cluster. And the light is being magnified and being distorted and producing many different images of the same object. It's really remarkable. This is curved space in front of your eyes. Nevertheless, as beautiful as it is, it's useful for us because we understand general relativity and we can work backwards and say, how much mass must there be in this system to produce this image? And where's the mass and how is it distributed? So we can invert the image, as it's called. It's numerically quite intensive, but we can do it. And here it is. Here's this cluster. And here's where all the mass is. The peaks represent, well, there's where the galaxies are. But you notice that in between the galaxies, where the galaxies aren't, there's huge amounts of mass. In fact, most of the mass of the system, 50 times as much mass in the system as contained in all the galaxies, is contained where the galaxies aren't. Contained in material that isn't shining. Now, physicists, with their incredible linguistic perspicacity, call this dark matter. And we have discovered that our galaxy and every galaxy and clusters of galaxies are dominated by this stuff that doesn't shine. And, of course, we want to know what it is. And again, as a particle physicist, that's the reason I really got into this, because if I knew how much dark matter there was, I'd know how much matter there was and whether the universe would expand forever or not. But one of the really exciting things we've learned is that there's so much of it that it can't be made of the same stuff that you and I are made of. It can't be made of protons and neutrons, the stuff that makes up you and I and everything in this room. We believe it has to be made of a new type of elementary particle, one that is so weakly interacting that, in fact, it's actually going right through this room, right through you now as you nod off during this lecture. Okay? In fact, that's what makes it exciting, because it's not just out there. We don't need telescopes to look for it. We can build devices here on Earth to try and detect it. I think I have a picture next of such a device. But before I show you that, I want to say, well, look, it doesn't matter what it is. We may not know what it is, but we now know how much of it there is. Using this, we have been able to weigh the universe, and here is the answer. Ta-da! Now, you see, physicists, whenever they come up with an important number, they give it a Greek letter to sound scholarly. And omega is a Greek letter that means the following. It's the ratio of the total amount of matter in the universe divided by the amount of matter to produce a closed universe, just at the boundary of a flat and closed universe. So if omega is bigger than 1, we live in a closed universe. If omega is equal to 1, we live in a flat universe. And if it's less than 1, we live in an open universe. So you see, definitively now, we appear to know that we live in an open universe and therefore know the future. There's a problem with this, however, and that is that theoretical physicists like me and Robert and others, we knew the answer again. We knew the answer. We knew we had to live in a flat universe. Okay, there's a few reasons for that. One is it's the only mathematically beautiful universe. The other reason, actually, what intrigues me is it's the only universe that you can think of as coming from nothing. And since I think the universe came from nothing, I'm prejudiced to think we live in a flat universe. But these damn observers were coming up with the wrong number. And that was a problem. Now, I think I just want to, before I go on to that problem, I just want to show you that these things really actually have an impact. We're actually talking about things we can measure. This is a dark matter detector. Actually proposed this type of detector 25 years ago, and it's nice to see them working now. It's quite simple to detect dark matter, we think. You just build this is a germanium, a boule of germanium. You put it in a detector, and you cool it to 1/1000th of a degree above absolute zero, which you can do with a refrigerator you buy. And then you just wait. And these dark matter particles, most of them will go right through this, the Earth, and right through this refrigerator. But every now and then, one of them will bounce off the nucleus of an atom of germanium, in this case, and heat the whole thing up by 1/1000th of a degree. And detectors like this are being put in mines in the United States, in Canada, in Japan, and we're patiently waiting, hopefully, to discover dark matter. In fact, recently, one in Minnesota, an experiment, claimed that they might actually have events. Not certain yet. They had two events, but they might be noise, and we're waiting to build bigger detectors. So we might be on the cusp of actually detecting this stuff directly. But let's go back. We have this open universe, and now we seem to be depressed as theorists because we were wrong. But this really isn't a measure of the geometry of the universe. It's a very indirect way to measure. We measure the amount of mass and the expansion rate, and we put a lot of things together. Wouldn't it be better to just measure the curvature of the universe directly? And the amazing thing is we can. And we've only been able to do it in the last decade. And I want to show you how. To talk about it, I want to ask you the following question. How would you measure the curvature of the Earth if you couldn't go around it or you couldn't get in a satellite to look above and see its curve? How would you do that? Well, simple. You draw a triangle, and then you ask a Canadian high school student, not an American one, what's the sum of the angles in a triangle? And they will tell you 180 degrees. And you'll say, right, but you learned your geometry from Euclid. You see, on a curved surface, it's quite different. Here's the Earth, and I can draw a triangle that's very different. Let me go along the equator and make a 90-degree angle and go up to the North Pole, and then a 90-degree angle, come back to the equator. And now I have a triangle with three right angles. 3 times 90 is 270. So if I drew a big enough triangle on the surface of the Earth, I would know it was curved because it's not 180 degrees. Now, what's truly amazing is exactly the same thing works for a curved three-dimensional space. If we were to find a big enough triangle, we could measure the curvature of our universe. And only in the last decade have we been able to find a big enough triangle, and I want to show it to you. It comes from the most important observation in cosmology, the cosmic microwave background radiation, the afterglow of the Big Bang. And it was discovered by accident in New Jersey, of all places, by two guys who didn't know what the hell they were doing. But they won the Nobel Prize anyway. Because you don't have to know what you're doing. You just have to discover something. And they discovered the afterglow of the Big Bang. And here's where it comes from. Here's the Earth. And when we look out at, say, distant galaxies a billion light years away, we're looking back in time. Because it takes light a billion years to get to us. And so, if the universe is 13.72 billion years old, you would think if you look far enough, 13.72 billion light years away, you would think, you would see the Big Bang. Now, in principle, that would be possible. But in practice, we can't. Because between us and the Big Bang, there's a wall. Not a physical wall, but essentially one. I can't see past this wall here because it's opaque. And when we look out at the universe, at earlier and earlier times, the universe was hotter and hotter and hotter. And at a certain time, when the universe was about 100,000 years old, it had a temperature of 3,000 degrees. And at 3,000 degrees Kelvin, hydrogen, the dominant stuff in the universe, gets broken apart into protons and electrons. And you don't have neutral matter anymore. You have what's called a charged plasma. And a plasma is opaque to radiation. You can't see through it. So you see, you're looking out here, and what happens, before this time, we've got an opaque universe. Light can't get out. It keeps bouncing around. But then as the universe cools, gets to 3,000 degrees, suddenly it cools enough so hydrogen, protons can capture electrons, become neutral matter. Neutral matter is transparent to radiation, and the radiation will come all the way to us here now. The same reason I can see the wall. The wall's opaque, but what happens is on the surface of that wall, it absorbs light from those lights. It's re-emitted at the surface, but the air is transparent, so I can see all the way to the wall. So if there was a Big Bang, we would predict that you'd see radiation coming at us from all directions, from that last scattering surface, as it's called. Now, it's cooled. It's now no longer 3,000 degrees as the universe has expanded by a factor of 1,000. It's cooled by a factor of 1,000. It's now about 3 degrees above absolute zero, and that's what they saw in New Jersey. And in fact, many of you have seen it too, by the way. those of you who are as old as me, for example, remember before the world before cable TV, you remember TV stations used to go off the air. And I used to watch TV, I hate to say, till the TV stations went off the air when I was a kid. And then there'd be static. And interestingly enough, if you unplug the cable on your TV and you look at the static, about 1% of the static that you're seeing is actually radiation from the Big Bang. So you've seen it before, you just didn't know what it was. Okay. Now, the neat thing about it is if we see that radiation, we get a picture of what the universe looked like when it was 100,000 years old. And I'll show you that baby picture in a second. But on that picture, there's one scale that's very important. 1 degree. Why? Because 1 degree represents a distance of about 100,000 light years across. Now, Einstein tells us that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. No information. And therefore, if this is 100,000 light years across and the universe is 100,000 years old, nothing that happened over here can affect anything that happens over there. And more importantly, if I have a lump of matter that's this big, well, it begins to collapse due to gravity and then it heaps up and all sorts of things happen. But if I have a lump of matter that's this big across, it doesn't even know it's a lump because gravity can't travel across it. So it won't collapse. It'd be like Wile E. Coyote on those cartoons. You know, he runs out of the cliff and he doesn't know he's supposed to fall. And so the largest lumps that can collapse at this time are lumps that are that big. And that gives us a ruler and a triangle. Because we have a 100,000 light year across ruler located a known distance away from us, and gives us a triangle. And that ruler will subtend on our eye. If the universe is flat and light rays travel in straight lines, it'll subtend an angle of 1 degree. The ruler will look like it's 1 degree across. But in an open universe, light rays bend outward as you go back in time. And the same ruler will subtend a smaller angle on our eye. The ruler will look smaller. The lump will look smaller, maybe half a degree. In a closed universe where light rays converge as you go back in time, the lump will look bigger. So all we have to do is get a picture of that surface, look at the lumps and say, are they half a degree, 1 degree, 2 degrees across, and we can find what the curvature of the universe is. And that's what we've done. And I know, it's really depressing. Where are I? But so this was the first experiment that was able to do it. It was an experiment in Antarctica. It's a balloon with a microwave receiver, and the balloon went up way above the Earth's atmosphere along with the microwaves, and the balloon went around the world, which is easy to do in Antarctica. The South Pole, it's really easy. But it wasn't quite at the South Pole. It took about 2 weeks to do it, and it took a picture of the microwave background radiation, and here it is. It's a false color image. I've superimposed it here on the original picture, just to give you a sense of scale. And these, and also to demonstrate our cosmic myopia, by the way, if we evolved, and since I'm in Canada, I'm still allowed to say that word, we evolved so that our eyes would see visible radiation. But if we evolved to see microwaves instead, then when we look out at night, we look all the way back to the microwave background surface and see that image. Now, these are false colors, but these are the lumps, the hot spots and the cold spots in the microwave background. And the question is, how big are they? And so we can compare it to our expectations, but here's another false color image of the same region. And we can build universes on a computer, a closed universe, a flat universe, an open universe, and simulate lumps, 100,000 light year across lumps. And here's a closed universe, and the average lump be about that big. Well, that's bigger than these lumps. Here's an open universe, and it turns out the average lump is about that big. But that's smaller than these lumps. But just like Goldilocks, in a flat universe, it's just right. And in fact, it's so just right that we now know to an accuracy of about 1% that the universe is precisely flat. We were right. But if you've been awake, you realize there's a problem because we just measured the amount of stuff in the universe and there's only 30% of the amount of stuff needed to make the universe flat. So where is the other stuff? Well, we measure all the stuff around galaxies. The only possibility is if the rest of the energy is where galaxies aren't, in empty space. Well, what would happen if you put energy in empty space? I remind you, it would produce something like a cosmological constant, which is a repulsive force. And that would cause the expansion of the universe to speed up with time, not slow down. And in 1998, a bunch of astronomers who didn't believe us because we said it'd be speeding up, tried to measure the rate at which the universe was slowing down. And here, this was on the cover of Science magazine. It doesn't look like much, but it was a revolution. This is the Hubble plot of the expansion of the universe function time. And the question of what happens very early on, very far away, does the curve bend up or down? And to get a picture of that, we can just draw a straight line through the whole thing, bring it down so the straight line is horizontal. And here's what everyone expected. They expected to measure these supernovae far away, falling along this curve as the universe slowed down. But what you see is they're above the straight line on average. And just for fun, if you want to fit, and ask how much energy would you have to add in empty space to fit this data, you get exactly what we were missing. If you put 70% of the universe in empty space, then 70% of the energy of a flat universe in empty space, you get exactly what we need, and that's exactly the amount we are missing. So everything holds together with a universe dominated by nothing. A universe, a cockamamie universe that we don't understand. I remind you, we discovered there's 50 times as much stuff as visible stuff in dark matter, but all of that only accounts for 30% of the total energy of the universe. So the first lesson I want to leave you with is how utterly insignificant you are. Okay? We account, if you got rid of all the stars and all the galaxies and everything you see on a beautiful night, the universe would be largely the same. We are a 1% bit of pollution in a universe dominated by dark matter and dark energy. So we don't matter at all. Okay, so much for a universe created for us. But anyway, the more important thing, as a scientist, is that we don't understand it. We have no idea why empty space has that kind of energy. Remember, if we actually tried to predict it, we got a number that's very different than this, so we assumed it was zero. We don't have the slightest idea why energy of empty space is what it is, and if anyone comes and tells you that they know that, especially if they're a string theorist, they're lying. Okay? But what makes it even more exciting is we think its existence is tied to the very nature of space and time and to the origin of our universe, and for more important for the rest of this talk, it will determine our future. It's changed everything about our future. So I want to spend the last few minutes of this talk talking about that. Now, you've been listening for a long time, so this is the short version of the next 10 minutes or so. And it's a graduation address that was given at a private girls' school in the United States. I've given two commencement addresses at universities, but I've never had the guts to say this, but he began by saying, things are going to get unimaginably worse, and they're never, ever going to get better again. Okay? And that was before the Bush administration, in fact. But in any case, here is the problem, why the universe is so miserable. The first reason the universe is so miserable is scientists have gone mad. Because of this energy of empty space is so weird that scientists have gone mad. This is a brief history of time. This is a graph that shows you the density of matter in the universe as the universe expands. The density goes down as 1 over the volume. And here are some markers. This is when galaxies first formed, when the solar system formed now, and when our sun dies. This is the energy of empty space, which remains constant. The energy density of empty space. And we live here. And the thing you should notice is, this is a very strange time to live. It's the only time, roughly, in the history of the universe when these two numbers are about the same. At all early times, the energy of matter is much more than the energy of empty space. At late times, the energy of empty space will be far in excess of that of matter. We live in the only time in the history of the universe when they're roughly the same, within a factor of 3. But we live 14 billion years after the Big Bang. Why should that happen now? It's not supposed to happen now. Copernicus told us there's nothing special about where we are or when we live, and it now seems we live at a very special time. How could that be? Well, scientists have said, here's the answer. The answer is we have galaxies. Now, why is that? Well, let's say the energy of empty space was, say, 40 times bigger than it is. So the curve, the energy was here, not there. What would happen? Well, these two curves would cross, but at a different point. They cross at the point when galaxies first formed. Now, the energy of empty space is gravitationally repulsive. So if it dominated before galaxies formed, galaxies wouldn't form. Because the repulsive force would beat the attractive force. And so people said, maybe this is telling us something. If galaxies never form, then we live in a very different universe. And this has produced something that I call anthropic mania. The argument is as follows. If there are many different universes, and if the energy of empty space can vary in each universe, then only in those in which it's not much greater than what we measure today will galaxies form. And then, only then will stars and planets form, and only then will astronomers form. So the universe is the way it is because astronomers are here to measure it. Now, it sounds ridiculous. And it's almost ridiculous, but it's not quite. Okay, it sounds like a tautology, but it's not quite. And it also sounds almost, for some people, religious. It sounds like the universe is designed for us to be here. But it's not really the case. In fact, the question is, science? Well, we can try and ask that question. But it isn't religion. It's really kind of a cosmic natural selection. Bees, we can ask, why are bees so finely tuned to measure, to be able to see the colors of flowers so they can get nectar? Well, the answer was, is they couldn't see the flower colors, they wouldn't get the nectar, and they wouldn't survive. This is really saying the same thing. It's not too surprising for us to find ourselves in a universe in which we can survive, because if it was a universe in which we couldn't survive, we wouldn't be here to ask the question. And so, it's a disgusting possibility. It's disgusting, why? Because if it's really true, it means that this kind of physics is really an environmental science. The fundamental energy of empty space is not something we predict from first principles, but it's an accident. It's an accident of our circumstances. And that goes against the whole grain of science over the last 400 years for me, where we've tried to explain why the universe has to be the way it is, rather than why it generically looked different. But particle physicists have jumped on this. Because, you see, particle physicists are way ahead of cosmologists. Cosmologists don't understand that one number. But particle physicists have not understood much more for much longer. We don't understand why gravity is the weakest force in nature. We don't understand why the proton is 2,000 times heavier than the electron. We don't understand why there are three generations of elementary particles. There's a ton of things we don't understand. And so some particle physicists have said, this is great. We don't have to understand anything. Because now we can say it's all an accident. It's all an accident. If we're any different, we wouldn't be here. So we don't need a theory of everything. We just need a theory of anything. And we have such a theory, they say. It's called string theory. So I have my one slide summary of string theory for those who haven't heard of it. So this is the history of string theory. So this is, one guy says to another, I just had an awesome idea. Suppose all matter and energy is made of tiny vibrating strings. And the second person says, okay, what would that imply? The first person says, I don't know. And so that's the history of string theory for the last 40 years. And it used to depress, for a while, even string theorists were depressed, because suddenly this theory didn't explain anything. It requires all these extra dimensions, and every way you compactify the extra dimensions, you end up with a different four-dimensional universe. And so it predicts a plethora of different universes, and in fact, it predicts a universe that's compatible with anything you could see, which is not a prediction at all. And so that was depressing to them. But once this came out, they said, oh great, we're going to call this a landscape. Sounds neater. We're going to say every different way you compactify those seven extra dimensions, you end up with a universe with a different energy, and we live in one of those. So this gives us a landscape in which we can explain the anthropic principle. Well, the problem is, if you can produce a universe that's compatible with anything, you haven't made any prediction at all. And this may be the future of physics. It may be that we'll never be able to make fundamental predictions about elementary quantities. I hope fervently it's not the case, but it may be the future of physics, and that would be depressing. But let me depress you more in the last bit. Another philosopher, Yogi Berra, who said, the future is not what it used to be. And in fact, true, because now, if we live in a universe dominated by the energy of empty space, the future is miserable. That's the second thing I want to tell you about. First, you're insignificant. And secondly, the future is miserable. Okay? Why? Well, the first person to realize that was, of course, George Orwell, who said, to see what is in front of one's eyes, nose, requires a constant struggle. Now, what did he mean by that? Well, this is obviously what he meant, of course. It's clear. Well, what this tells us is that in a universe with an energy of empty space, the universe expands exponentially. Operationally, what it means is, we call d dot velocity. The velocity of objects is proportional to the distance, just like Hubble measured, but the constant of proportionality is a constant for all time. And that means if the distance is big enough, then the velocity is bigger than the speed of light. That means objects a certain distance away from us are traveling away from us faster than the speed of light. Now, that's not possible, you think. Because I told you nothing could travel faster than the speed of light. But as I told a class today, you have to parse that more carefully. Objects can now travel through space faster than the speed of light, but space can do whatever the hell it wants. And space can carry away objects faster than the speed of light. And in a universe that's accelerating, that's exactly what's happening. And in fact, we can ask, how far away are objects moving away at the speed of light from us now? And we work out 18 billion light years away from us. Objects are moving away from us faster than the speed of light. Or anything farther away is moving away faster. And if it's moving away faster, we can't see it. The light can never catch up with the expansion of space. So in such a universe, the longer we wait, the less we'll see. Actually, let me go back. I was worried I put the equations there, but I didn't. So let's come back here. In such a universe, the longer we wait, the less we'll see. Galaxies that we can now see are speeding up, and in the future, will be moving away from us faster than the speed of light and will disappear. And we can calculate how long that will take. In fact, it will take a time about a trillion years. So in a trillion years, we won't be able to see anything. And now I've tried to use that with Congress in the United States to suggest they fund cosmology now while we have a chance. But there's an impedance mismatch because the long-term future for a congressperson in the States is 2 years, not 2 trillion years, so it hasn't worked. But now I want to tell you something that may make you feel good or bad. In the far future, what will happen? It's really kind of amazing to me that in the far future, the picture that scientists will have of the universe will be quite different than the one we have now. Scientists around a different star that evolved on a planet far, far away, not anyone related to us, okay? Because what picture will they come up with? Well, remember the picture we began this lecture with in 1900 and 1916? Einstein began with a static universe with a single galaxy surrounded by an infinite empty space. What will observers and scientists in the far future come up with? Well, they'll develop general relativity, they'll understand quantum mechanics, they'll understand electromagnetism, they'll build telescopes, and they'll come up and they'll do the best experiments they can do. And what picture will they come up with? They'll come up with a picture that's exactly wrong. They'll come up with a picture of the universe that looked just like the universe we thought we lived in 100 years ago. A universe with a single galaxy surrounded by empty, static space. This is a galaxy. It's not our galaxy. Why? Yeah, I just want to see if you're awake. Yeah, we live in our galaxy. Okay, this is the Andromeda galaxy. We'd live about there if it was our galaxy. We've seen one spiral galaxy. You've seen them all. Observers in the far future will live in a universe with a single galaxy. And they'll have no idea it's expanding. Why? Because all of the pillars of the Big Bang will have disappeared. The Hubble expansion, the thing that tells us the universe is expanding, is based on observing other galaxies moving away from us. But in the far future, there won't be any other galaxies moving away from us that we can see. So there'll be no Hubble expansion. There'll be no evidence for dark energy. Because the only way we know there's dark energy is measuring the speed up of the universe. We measure the speed of the universe up of the universe by measuring galaxies. And in fact, in a trillion years, the energy density of matter over the energy density of dark energy will be one part in a million million. But the dark energy will still be invisible. In fact, the only time you can measure it is today. Because when the energy of dark energy is much, much less than the energy of matter, it doesn't affect the expansion, so it's invisible. When it's much greater, it's pushed all the galaxies away. So we live in the only time in the history of the universe when we could have measured the dark energy. But you might say, okay, well, what about this beautiful cosmic microwave background radiation that you talked about? It gives us evidence of the Big Bang, doesn't it? Yes, it does. But it's going to go away, too. For a few reasons. One, as the universe expands, it turns out the intensity of the microwave background will go down. But it's even worse than that. Our galaxy contains free electrons, and therefore our galaxy is a plasma. And radiation, as I told you, below a certain frequency can't make it through a plasma. That frequency is about a kilohertz. And if you work things out, when the universe is about 50 times its present age, the microwave background radiation won't even be able to permeate the galaxy. So even if you built a detector, you couldn't see it. And for reasons I don't have time to go in, every single pillar of the Big Bang will have disappeared. In the far future, observers will measure things and decide they live in what's called a static de Sitter universe, the same universe that Einstein thought he lived in back 100 years ago. And so it's kind of poetic. The far future will bring people back to exactly the wrong conclusion. Falsifiable science will lead to a false conclusion. Now, I want to leave you with some good news. The good news is we live in a very special time. The only time when we can observationally verify that we live in a very special time. And I hope you catch the sarcasm in that. Because what I really want to leave you with is some kind of cosmic humility. We have, through our telescopes and our ideas, come up with this amazing picture of the universe that hangs together beautifully. A universe dominated by dark matter and dark energy. But maybe if we'd evolved 5 billion years earlier, there would have been observables we could see that we can't see now. Maybe 50 billion years from now, there'll be things that in the universe that we can't see now that will tell us on some fundamental way that the universe is quite different. So while we think we have this picture and it's all holding together, we really should remember that we're just beginning to learn about the universe. And there's some things, because we live in one universe, that may forever be unknown. So the real moral is that the future, this is what the future is really going to be like if it's dominated by dark energy. We'll be lonely and ignorant, but dominant. And those of us who live in the United States are used to that. Thank you very much. Okay. Well, we have time for a few questions. I'll take just a few questions in public, and I'll be happy to hang around later. But I know some of you have to go to the bathroom and things. So any questions? There we go. Yes. So if you could just be patient, I'll take a few, and that way people won't be running in and out. Yeah.
I'm not a physics student, but I still really know what I'm
doing. Well, you're not allowed to ask
the
question. No,
but at this point, is that place where the objects move away from us fast in the speed of light, is that beyond what you described as the wall?
You asked a very good question. Because, you know, that you'd think the wall is further away than that. But really, the wall is not a wall. I kind of lied. The cosmic microwave background radiation is everywhere, permeating all space. So we won't be able to see objects which are located further than a certain distance away from us. But since the cosmic microwave background radiation is permeating all space at all times, even as the universe expands, we're seeing the radiation that was closer to us than that distance at that time. Okay? So the way to think about it is, it's everywhere, and it just gets diluted, and in fact its energy density goes down, but it's not emanating from a certain place. The Big Bang didn't happen at some point in space. It happened everywhere. And the radiation from the Big Bang is everywhere. The things we won't be able to see are the things that are somewhere. A galaxy that's far away. But the radiation is everywhere and permeates all of space. So, in principle, we can always see it. The problem is, in the far future in our galaxy, the radiation won't be able to permeate the plasma in our galaxy. But it's, you know, it'll be absorbed in the outskirts of our galaxy. Okay? Hope that helps. It's a good question. Next. Yes?
What do we know about the origins of the Big Bang?
What do we know about the origin of the Big Bang? Not very much. That's why I'm directing an institute in Arizona called Origins. Because we want to learn about not just about the origin of the universe, but the origin of planets and solar system and life and cognition. In my opinion, in terms of science, almost all the interesting questions at the cusp have to do with origins, and that's why we've created this institute. But we don't know. The laws of physics as we understand them take us back to almost the Big Bang. But one thing we do know is that we don't understand what happened at the Big Bang, because at that point we need to understand how gravity and quantum mechanics work together. We need a quantum theory of gravity. And some string theorists think that they might have a quantum theory of gravity someday. But right now we don't have a theory that allows us to understand what happened at that time. So all bets are off. It doesn't stop physicists from speculating. But you might wonder what happened before the Big Bang. And now, to upset you, I'll give you an answer that won't make you happy. But it might be true. It's the same answer Stephen Hawking would say. And that is, it's a crummy question. Because before may not mean anything. General relativity tells us that space and time are coupled to matter. And when all of matter was together at a single point, what we mean by space and time may be different. Time may have come into existence after the Big Bang. It may not have even existed before the Big Bang. So asking the question may be the wrong question. It's fascinating to think about, but we don't know the answer.
What?
Okay, so let me answer. So if there are parallel universes, people have to talk about them. If indeed there are many universes, there could be. In fact, this is another picture that may make you happy. if this picture, and there are many theories called inflation and other things that predict there may be many, many, the universe is infinite in spatial extent, and our Big Bang is just one small region of a multiverse which contains many universes. In some of those universes, there's a Big Bang happening right now. In other universes, it's collapsing. On large scales, the universe looks always the same. And in that case, you can, for, if it's philosophically more appealing to you, you can imagine we live in a multiverse, and our local myopic picture of the universe beginning was just our region of the universe beginning. In other regions of the universe, other things are happening. We don't know if that's the case. And for reason, I'll be happy to talk to you afterwards about ways that we might get an inkling of that. But right now, it's just pure speculation, and we just don't know the answer. It's fascinating speculation, but to understand it, we have to understand the laws of physics better than we do. Are you? Yes, yeah.
I read in a popular science magazine that some people think that maybe antimatter is anti-gravitational. They'll try and actually weigh it. What do you think about all this? I mean,
well, most people are wrong. No, the amazing thing about antimatter, it's antimatter is very sexy. It has, you know, it sounds like something that's in Star Trek, and I'm contractually obliged to mention Star Trek in each lecture, so I just did. But it's not really exotic. It's as exotic as Belgians are. Let me do an experiment. How many Belgians in this room? See? You never see them. They're not. If you go to Belgium, they're not very strange, but you never see them anywhere else. And antimatter is only strange because we happen to live in a universe full of matter. But the laws of physics tell us that antimatter should behave just like matter. You could have the Earth could be made of antimatter, and the Sun could, and the Moon, and you could have anti-lovers and living in anti-cars making anti-love, and looking up at an anti-moon. It wouldn't be any different. So antimatter falls in a gravitational field, and it's no different. It's unfortunately not the stuff on which... It's strange and interesting, but not that strange and not that interesting. And we make it all the time in laboratories. It's not something that's the stuff of science fiction. At Fermilab in Chicago, we make antimatter all the time, and we can measure its properties. And in fact, we will do the experiment that you want to do, which is to create positrons and watch them fall in a gravitational field. But we have no reason to believe that they won't, because the laws of physics tell us that and the laws of physics, which, by the way, explain everything else we can measure right, have as an ancillary prediction that they'll fall. But you're absolutely right. We've got to look. It would be cool if we were wrong. Maybe that's the best way to end this lecture. No, I really want to point this out because it's the biggest misconception about science, is that scientists want to be right. It's not that they want to be wrong. They want their colleagues to be wrong. And it's really true. That's what makes you famous. We go into work every day hoping we're going to prove our colleagues wrong because that's when things get interesting. And one of the big problems that people have is thinking that scientists are so afraid of being wrong that they'll invent this thing called evolution or global warming and they won't listen to anyone else. In fact, if you could show that evolution was wrong, you'd be famous. If you could show that global warming was, that your models predicted global warming wasn't going to happen, which isn't the case, then you'd be famous. And so the greatest thing we can give our children is to help them be wrong. Because then there's stuff left to do. And the fact is, one of the most exciting things about dark energy is that it means we don't understand anything. And that's an exciting place to be, because it means there's a lot left to do, and we have to continue to search the universe. Thank you very much. It looks like you have to.
So I'd just like to thank Professor Krauss on behalf of the Faculty of Science and the organizers of today's event, Department of Anatomy and Cell Biology, Department of Earth and Planetary Science, particularly Dr. Valley, who's done so much work in this great series. As a Dean of Science, I go to a lot of meetings where people are trying to direct money from this desk to this desk to this desk, followed by other meetings where we talk about the future of the university. I think just looking at the attendance here today, we see what universities are about. They're about the search for fundamental knowledge and the excitement that engenders. I'd like to have another round of applause for Professor Krauss.